in Hebrew in the first handout. Is that right, Andy? Is that right? That's that the first time. And we sort of got up to... So let me remind you of what his point was. He began by saying that the initial interaction between the Kabbalah and the Halacha was in the framework where the Kabbalah was sort of trying to anchor itself in traditional sayings or midrashim or halachot. And you see that in the Sefer HaBahir, where he tries to give some rationale as to why only very particular halachot were chosen by the Sefer HaBahir to illustrate Kabbalistic principles. From there he moved on to the school of first of all Rabbi Isaac the Blind, the son of the Rebbe himself, and then to the school of Girona, where theoretically in the Perush on Shir HaShirim, which is by Ezra of Girona but attributed to the Ramban, there is a list of Tariyat Mitzvot, the list itself being chosen rather abruptly by simply copying the Rambam's short list, that is Rambam list that the Rambam himself abbreviated for the Yad HaChazakah. And the stated program of Ezra of Girona was to provide a Kabbalistic interpretation to those mitzvot which don't necessarily have a more rational one. But he doesn't really quite live up to this program, because some of his explanations are not Kabbalistic, and others of his explanations apply to mitzvot, which already have some kind of an application. And it's interesting. Let's turn to the bottom of Katz's page 24. So that's my page 15 on my initial handout. And let's just simply go through one of his illustrations. Ma'alfim biyoter, is that passage there. It's extremely impressive to see what Rav Ezra wrote in connection to the mitzvah of Shvuah and Neder. And here is a basis to say that his annotations are his own innovations. According to his programmatic declaration, these two mitzvot, that is the law of Shvuah and the law of Neder, are included in the category of those commandments that don't have explicit reasons given for them. Nevertheless, when he reaches them in his account of the mitzvot, he doesn't give any Kabbalistic interpretation to the positive or negative commandments that are connected to the laws of Shvuah and the Neder. He simply writes, to fulfill what a person promises, that is, from Neder that a person undertakes, and not to postpone fulfillment of such a neder, and secondly, not to violate an explicit oath, and not to swear falsely. All of these are just simple statements of the mitzvot without any particular Kabbalistic spin on their interpretation. On the other hand, he is very attracted to the particular halacha that is mentioned in Masechet Nedarim, and in the Sefer Shvuot, according to which a neder, that is an oath, which has the form of an edit neder, and there are two types of oaths, one is called a neder and the other is called a shvuah. A neder can apply to an object of a mitzvah as well as to an ordinary object, which is not the case with a shvuah. In other words, if a person takes an oath to violate a positive commandment or a negative commandment, or not to fulfill a positive commandment, that oath does not apply. It's not binding on it, because a person cannot take an oath to override the oath that he already took at Har Sinai to fulfill the commandments of the Torah. So the implication of this rule is explained in the Mishnah Nedarim, that a person, that an oath, that is a neder, not to fulfill a particular mitzvah. For example, if someone says that I take an oath against a sukkah that I'm going to build, or a love that I'm going to have to hold, the neder does exist. In other words, the nether does apply. But if someone swears, as opposed to taking a nether, swears not to fulfill a mitzvah, that kind of a shvuah does not apply. The reason for this distinction is explained well according to the concepts of the halacha. According to the language of the Rambam, if someone swears, that is nishpa, swears to prevent himself on something, to prohibit himself on something that he swore about, and he is already sworn from Mount Sinai, this particular oath doesn't supersede the oath that he has already taken. In other words, if a man takes an oath not to fast on Yom Kippur, if a man takes an oath to fast on Shabbat, or any other type of thing which will prevent, will go against whatever a commandment is, then it's not applied. But on the other hand, a neder, if a person
does it go against, or does it go for? In other words, if he takes an oath too fast on Yom Kippur, it's still a nullity.
It's also a nullity, but the one thing that we're concerned with here is the opposite. That is, where a person takes an oath in violation of the law of the Torah. V'ilu hanoder neder, if someone takes a neder shelo lasot et ha-mitzvah, then the oath does apply to the object. And that object, because, Rambam says, that object itself, the object as opposed to the person, has not been sworn at Mount Sinai. And as Professor Katz explains, a shvuah is considered a personal obligation. And a new personal obligation cannot uproot a previous personal obligation, namely one that he has from Mount Sinai. Whereas a neder not to sit in a sukkah or not to take a lulav prohibits the sukkah and the lulav on the person. It is, to use modern halachic terminology, an isur chetza, something that applies to the object rather than the person. And there is no direct conflict between this prohibition of the object, namely the fact that this lulav has become prohibited, or this sukkah, or all lulavim, or all sukkot have become prohibited, and his oath at Mount Sinai, which obliges him to fulfill a mitzvah. So, I don't know, this concept of the distinction between personal obligation and laws of objects probably in its original form derives or is associated with Roman law, which you could probably know better than I, which makes a fuss over the difference between the laws of persons and the laws of objects. And in this particular case, it got absorbed into the halacha as a distinction between a neder, which is considered a law of an object, applying to an object, and an oath, which is considered a personal obligation. As you well know, in the Briska Shita of the learning, this has sort of been elevated to a supreme halachic principle, extending it far beyond anybody's previous intention of trying to utilize this concept of the difference between personal obligations and laws of objects. But in any event, whether or not you're happy with this as a halachic formulation, and whether or not you're interested in whether it has roots in some other legal system, it is a mode of halachic reasoning. A mode of halachic reasoning which says that an oath, if someone swears an oath, a shvuah is a personal obligation, and therefore cannot override previous personal obligations, whereas a neder applies to an object, and the object itself doesn't have personal obligations, and therefore can be prohibited. A man can make this object, or whatever it is, prohibited on himself. If a man says that all cream cheese is prohibited for me, that is a neder, then he's not allowed to eat the cream cheese. But the theory behind this, whether you enjoy the here theory or like it or not, that's not the point here. There is a legal principle derived from wherever which distinguishes between laws of objects and laws of persons. So you may be happy with it, or like me, you may be slightly unhappy with trying to deal with this as a general principle, but the theory behind it, the fact behind it, is that it is part of a legal construct. has nothing to do with Kabbalah or mysticism or anything. It's just part of a legal system. You can imagine that you have a legal system which distinguishes between the law of persons and the law of objects. Okay. Now, but Rav Ezra, the Professor Katz writes, ignores completely this halachic explanation of why a shvua to violate a commandment does not apply, and a neder to violate a commandment does apply, and makes the distinction rely on an entirely different basis, because the neder and the shvua are anchored in different realms of the sfirot, different realms of the Godhead. This is what Rav Ezra writes, that a neder is something that has no limit, and it is above all the midot. And of course, for a Kabbalist, the word midot means the sfirot. This is something that lies above the sfirot and is above the structure of the mitzvot. And therefore, its strength is great to destroy and to uproot a mitzvah. Whereas a shvuah and a mitzvah, the shvuot and the mitzvot, they are the midot. Those apply to the lower sfirot. And for this reason, there's no power in a shvuah to uproot the mitzvot. And the phrase shvuah will prove this, because it is a word that's built out of the root shiva, seven. And since because it is part of the fulfillment of the sphero. In other words, Professor Katz explains, the meaning of this is apparently that a neder is not tied to number. And whereas a shvua is tied to the number seven, that is the seven lower sphirot in which all of the mitzvot are anchored. Therefore, the shvua lies on the same plane with the mitzvah. And one is not capable of uprooting the other, which is not the case of a neder, whose root is above number, and its strength is sufficiently great to destroy the mitzvah. One cannot question, of course, this kind of Kabbalistic explanation, just as one does not question the halachic distinction, which is dependent upon the category of explanations of the halacha, namely the difference between the personal realm and the realm of objects. But the question is, who forced the Kabbalist to make a drasha precisely on this particular halacha, which is one detail among hundreds of details in the laws of Shuot and the Darim? Why did Rabbi Yisro of Girona fix precisely on this particular halacha? The answer Rabbi Ezra himself hands us in a citation that precedes his explanation. And it is taken from the Sifri of Parshat Matot. And this is the language of the Sifri. Ma hefresh bein nedarim l'shvuot, what is the difference between nedarim, that is oaths which apply to objects, and shvuot, which are swearings of persons? V'nedarim k'noder v'chayei hamelech. In the case of nedarim, it's as if he's taking an oath in the life of the king. U'v'shvuot, and in the case of the shvuah, k'nishpa v'melech atzmo. As if he is taking an oath in the king itself. V'achal pi she'en raya l'davar, zeche l'davar, k'hei Hashem v'chei nafshecha im ezbein. So that there's somehow a difference between the phrase Chei Hashem, which is an oath replying to God, and Chei Nafshecha, which is an oath applying to the soul, or rather the soul of God. Now, there is, as Professor Katz writes, this sentence has a clear mystical ring. The Kabbalist was impressed by it, because it seems to give preference to the neder over the shvuah, and he connected this drasha with the particular law which emphasizes this power that a neder has above a shvua. In its original meaning, in the Sifri, this sentence came to explain an entirely different halakha, having to do with the issue of whether someone takes an oath which is based on an exaggeration. If someone takes an oath saying, I would do such and such if I didn't see as many people as those who exited from the Mitzrayim, or if I didn't see a snake as thick as the house, as the beam of the house, and so on. In other words, if an oath is taken to substantiate a hyperbolic statement, the question is whether it applies or doesn't apply. But there, in fact, the halacha is reversed. The halacha says that if a person takes a shvu'ah, which is based on an exaggerated statement, the shvu'ah applies. And if a person takes a neder based on an exaggeration, nederi habayit doesn't apply. Exactly the opposite of the principle that Rav Ezra of Girona tried to derive from the so-called mystical statement. So here's a situation, as Professor Katz explains, that the source of why he was attracted to this particular statement was because it had this kind of a mystical ring. In fact, it's not at all clear what the correct text of the Sifri is, because if you take a look in the Ran in Nedarim, the Ran in Nedarim, page 64a, writes, Ilo ha'ita yodea kishenadarta sha'aita mekel v'kavona makom da'aminam v'sifri shehu kenodea v'melech atzmo. So apparently, according to the Ran, a person who's nodea v'melech atzmo is more serious than nodea v'chayei ha'melech. But the Kabbalist gave exactly the opposite opinion. Just as the soul of a person is more important than his actual existence, and somehow or other, the soul of God lies above of the, I won't use the phrase kabiyachal, the body of God, and that the, and therefore there was this mystical ring attached to the sentence, and therefore the Kabbalist, Rabbi Ezra of Girona, took this whole Sifri and distorted it and gave an entirely different meaning to it and connected it with a halacha to which it is halachically unrelated. It is interesting, for example, that if you look at the one man of that period who was a great halachist, in addition to being a great Kabbalist, who was the Ramban, in his purely halachic work, that is, in his Chidushim and Masechet Shvuot, he simply takes the Sifri straight. That is, he says that Mahafresh Bein Nedarim L'Shvuot B'Nedarim K'Neder B'Chayei HaMelech B'Shvuot K'Nishpa B'Melech Atzmo Aval Pish Ein Ra'ayah L'Dav Azek L'Dav Achei Hashem Yochei Nafshecha In Ezveka U'Shma Minei, the Ramban writes, She'Shvuot HaBa'ay Asurot K'lomar She'Ne'esah HaDavah She'Nishpa Allah. In other words, exactly as Professor Katz says, that a Shvuah has a greater realm of applicability as far as this law is concerned, namely that it will apply even when it's based on an exaggerated statement, on a hyperbolic statement, whereas a neder won't. None of this has any halakhic consequence. It's just an illustration of how a statement which was originally just mystical sounding is has been sort of used to build a...
Yeah, that all sounds rather arbitrary. At the time that it was first enunciated, was there no challenge to it? Did anybody say...
What is interesting is that the Ramban, who's sort of a split personality on this...
Goes along with it.
Well, he doesn't go along with it in his halachic writings.
Mm-hmm.
He does go along with it in his more Kabbalistic writings, like his Perush on the Torah. And in his Hey, Rosh HaNetzorah, he deals with your question precisely by introducing something that hadn't existed before, namely that the Torah is to be explained on various different levels. There's the level of Pshat on the one hand, and then there's the level which he calls Al-Derech HaEmet, the true meaning, which is the Kabbalistic meaning on the other. And therefore, since these two things are on different levels, the issue of whether or not they're arbitrary or conflict with one another doesn't cause much of a problem to him, the Ramban. Once in a while, as Professor Katz points out, the Ramban cannot offer any reasonable explanation on the level of pshat, and therefore is drawn to necessarily use a Kabbalistic explanation. The best example of that is the law of Yibum. The Torah says that if a man dies without issue, without children, then his brother is to perform, is to marry his wife, as the Torah says, so that the child, the offspring, can carry the name of the father. Now, whether...
Transfer the soul.
According to the Ramban, this was an issue of transmigration of the soul. That the soul of the deceased brother is going to be reincarnated in the child. And that's a purely Kabbalistic explanation, because the notion of transmigration of the souls was something which was quite foreign to Judaism prior to those centuries. So there's an illustration where the Ramban as a Kabbalist was overwhelmed with, overcame the Ramban as a halakhic authority. I think it's useful to see, just to simply to read Professor Katz's summary to this, of this article before we move on to the next, to the main subject tonight, which is the beginning of the analysis of the halakhic implications of the Zohar. So I'm now going to turn to page 18 of my handout, which is, what is it, page 31 of Professor Katz's article. In our investigation of the first contacts between halakha and Kabbalah, we did not find until now about the problems which derived from the mutual attraction between halakha and Kabbalah, except in some hidden fashion. The main contact between them did not derive from their essence or their nature. The halakha was certainly capable of standing, of existing and functioning without having to lean on the Kabbalah. And the Kabbalah could also function and develop without bringing into its matters, without need of matters of the halakha. The contact that was created between them was the fruit of a historical circumstance. It was a consequence of the fact that both of them were parallel dwellings within the system of ideas and thoughts of the Jewish religion. The interlacing of these two fields was created, in fact, in the consciousness of those people who were involved in both traditions, even if they weren't equally involved in each one or the other of the traditions.
Why is the halakha separate from Judaism?
He didn't say it was separate from Judaism. Professor Katz said was that theoretically there was no need for the halacha and the Kabbalah to interact at all. The halacha could have functioned without any contact with the Kabbalah, and the Kabbalah could have developed without any input from the halacha. The fact that there was a contact between the two derived from the fact that both were spiritual or cultural parts of the Jewish tradition, of Jewish religion. And therefore, it was inevitable that they interacted, because people who were active in one or the other of these fields was knowledgeable, or to some extent knowledgeable in both. That's all that he's saying. Yes?
Though that's perhaps true, it follows that had it not had this interweaving not taken place, Kabbalah could never have become canonical, right?
Probably. Probably. Yeah. That's what he said at the beginning, that the Kabbalists needed this in order to get themselves established. But let's read his analysis further. It seems to me, he writes on the next page, that from this perspective one can distinguish between two types. One is recognized by the fact that his main mental construct is dependent mainly on the system of halakhic argumentation and halakhic decision, whereas the Kabbalah fills a side function as far as he is concerned. At any rate, at least as far as the attention which he devotes to both subjects. Thus, we can, for example, describe the Ravid and perhaps also the Ramban. The latter, of course, gave a Kabbalah an utmost, relegated to the utmost level as a source of spiritual meaning to Judaism. But the main thrust of his force, his intellectual force, he devoted to the development of the halacha rather than the Kabbalah. The fact that he was completely immersed in the world of the halacha didn't prevent him to be at the same time fruitful in the field of the Kabbalah. But on this particular fruitfulness, there was a very severe limit placed, that the Kabbalah itself should not trespass into the domain of the halacha. The Ramban accepted the explanation of the Sifri of Rav Ezra as far as the difference between Shvuah and Neder is concerned, and combined it with a halachic explanation which contradicts it, in fact, certainly because he thought that the Kabbalistic explanation of this tradition was ancient and was in the world of tradition, and in the world of tradition, it is certainly conceivable that two different explanations can contradict one another, even and live in the same house. Nevertheless, we don't find anywhere that the Ramban actually took a halachic statement from its simple meaning because of a Kabbalistic method, and certainly he did not invent new halachic practices according to mystical motivations. The innovation in the halacha, such as that of trying to make the bracha of Elokei David, which you mentioned last week, doesn't have any mention, any companion at all in the work of the Ramban. The fact that his halachic alertness would prevent him from being drawn after any Kabbalistic motivations which led to innovations in the mind of someone which did not have this alertness to halakhic sensibilities. Such innovations are of this type. They are the domain of the second type, whose main characteristic is an extra weight given to the Kabbalah over the halacha in his education. Even within this type, we're talking about someone who's a Talmud Chacham, that is someone who acquired a certain amount of expertise in the literature of the halacha, which was always the basis of the education of people who knew the Torah. Baggage of knowledge of halacha was a condition that its concepts could turn into Kabbalistic symbols in the consciousness of this type of a scholar. But the this degree of knowledge of the halacha does not imply the ability to enter into the halachic discussions, nor does it imply a mastery of the method of decision-making. It's possible that this type of possibility would be limited not because of a lack of knowledge, but because of the fact that the person's attention was drawn completely to the Kabbalah, and that all of his innovative powers were devoted to its development. In these types of situations, the system of the halacha can break down and they put into its various elements, and these turn into building materials in order to erect the structure of the Kabbalah. Even a a beam from the halachic construction can be removed from one area to another, and the foundations are harmed and are made crooked. And there, and from this you can find real deviations or imaginary ones in the matters of halacha, which are interweaved with the words of the Kabbalists. We found examples of this in the work of...
Literally, so
is that. Right. So what he's saying is that there are types who are principally halachics, even though they have an interest in the Kabbalah. And for those types of people, like the Ramban or the Raiva, the Kabbalah has no impact on the halachic creativity, innovation, and they're always alert to any such type of influence. But a person of the second type, like Ezra of Girona, who may be knowledgeable in the field of halacha, but his main interests lie in the Kabbalah, for such a person who has no capability of real innovation or ability to come to a halachic decision, and his whole and sole originality lies in the realm of the Kabbalah, such a person is likely to have the halacha itself modified and distorted by the Kabbalah.
Because he's saying that eventually they can end up like
that. Well, he's saying, let's take this slowly.
Yeah, I understand earlier.
Let's take it slowly. What he is saying is that we have to distinguish between these two types, mm-hmm. and that's going to be a guidepost in his methodology as we go. Now we're going to come to the main topic, and we'll work our way through chapter one of this.
Parenthetically, what is the take of current day scholars on the Ramban? Was he primarily a halachist who was doing this for public relations
or
for political pressure?
It's not public relations. He believed in the Kabbalah, and but as Professor Katz says, his main field of innovation was in the halacha. And therefore, since that was his main field of creativity and innovation and strength, mm-hmm. the fact that he had a profound influence in Kabbalah did not impinge on any of his halachic decisions. As we move on later in time, we will see
swing the pendulum the other way.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
Was the Ramban, who was also from Harana, Girona, were they contemporary?
Yes, sure.
Yes. So they were in dialogue.
The same school. Yes, they definitely were in the same school. Okay? All right. Now we will begin with chapter one in Professor Katz's book. This makes life for me very easy, because all I have to do is collect for you, here is the handouts for tonight in that box, collect for you many of the sources that Professor Katz mentions.
So,
and let's begin. So it'll take us, I think, two or three shiurim to go through the first of Professor Katz's articles, and then there's a break for Thanksgiving, Wednesday night before Thanksgiving. I will be out of town. Okay. So.
It would quote the Zohar, but it never was for the purpose of making halacha.
Well, if you take a look, for example,
identifying the speech, that's all.
Right. But now, if you take a look at, for example, of Mordechai Eliyahu's many of his recent decisions, you can read them. I think in Jewish press, if you're a subscriber, are based to a very great extent on Kabbalistic sources, which are not within the framework of traditional halachic rulings. So if we take a look at our current times, if you remember, sometimes in this year we try to anticipate problems which will come into existence in a year or two, at least be ahead of the game. All right. So the first category of halachot in the Zohar, and these are halachic changes attributed to the Zohar, which Professor Katz describes. We'll go through two or three of them tonight, and then go through the rest of them in Yetzer Shem next week. Professor Katz points out that these are really not, strictly speaking, purely Zoharistic innovations, but rather they are adoptions of customs which may have existed in other Jewish communities. And he's going to go through a whole bunch of them. In a later period, for example, with the adoption of Kabbalistic ritual in Eastern Europe, as you know, people began to daven in Nusach Ari, and basically the Hasidim adopted a Sephardic ritual, some somewhat modified Sephardic ritual, as an act of rebellion against the existing Ashkenazic tradition. In the time of the Tsar, which is a couple of centuries earlier, two or three centuries earlier, we will find that the author of the Tsar is adopting some Ashkenazic traditions, which or traditions which were at least partially existent in the Ashkenazic communities, as an act of rebellion against the existing Sephardic custom. So it was sort of, excuse me, just a minute, it was just a minor form of rebellion. Okay. So the first item on the agenda is this first thing that we've mentioned, and this is a quote from the Magen Avraham, he starts with. So I'm looking at page 14, page 13 of Professor Katz's book. And in the handout, you have, I brought you the Magen Avraham. Yeah? I assume you all have a copy of the book. Okay. Katuv Bizar, this is the Magen Avraham writing. Katuv b'Zohar Reish Parashat Dvarim Sheyomar Havlan Unevarech, that when you have a zimun at the end of the meal, someone should say Havlan Unevarech. What does the phrase Havlan Unevarech mean? Well, bring what?
The Katuv b'Zohar.
Okay, so originally the meaning of the phrase Havlan Umevarech, as it is quoted in the Gemara Psachim, if you take a look at page 180 in my handout, that is the second page of tonight's handout, it says, Korei Elayu Rav Yaiba Saba Amule Havlan Umevarech. Rav Yaiba Saba was acting as the waiter, and they said to him, bring us some wine so that we can say Berachat Mazon. L'sof amule havlan v'nishti. Then they changed their mind and said, bring us some wine so that we can have some more drink. Amar lehu hachi amar Rav. He, the waiter, was a great rabbi, said to them, this is what Rav said, kevan da'amrihu havlan v'nivrich. Since you made the statement, bring us a cup of wine so that we can say Berachat Mazon, itzeru luchu l'nishti. You can no longer drink my taima, the asiki datai, because you've turned your attention away from eating. In other words, you've decided that the meal is over, and therefore the bracha of borei pri agafen that you made initially at the beginning of the meal to cover all wine drunk during the meal lost its force. You decided that you were stopping to drink because you were going to say brachat hamazon. So in the Talmud, the phrase Havlan v'nivrech simply was a story. It was part of a particular story in which some people were sitting around and they said to the waiter, bring us a cup of wine so we can say Berachat Hamazon, and then that raised the halakhic problem as to whether they could then drink any further wine without making a bracha b'nei pri agafen on the wine, or whether they should in fact not first bench and then make a b'nei pri agafen on the additional wine. In other words, in the text of the Gemara, the phrase Havlan v'nivrich is not part of any ceremony. It's simply a statement that raised the problem in the Gemara. And the Rambam, for example, doesn't mention it. Here's the Rambam on that same page. The three people eat bread together. They have to say Berachat HaZimun before the Berachat HaMazon. The Ezehu Berachat HaZimun. Im hayu ha'ochlim yishlosha ad asara, if there are three up to ten people, mevarech echad mehem va'omer nevarech she'achalnu mishalo. One says nevarech she'achalnu mishalo, v'hakol onim baruch she'achalnu mishalo v'tuvo chayim. Baruch chozer v'omevarech baruch she'achalnu mishalo v'tuvo chayim, etc. The phrase havlan v'nevarech, havlan v'nivrech, doesn't exist in the Rambam ceremony. Yes, of course. Three men, right. Three through nine men. Okay. However, the Magen Avraham cites what is our custom. So let's read the Magen Avraham again. Katuv b'Zohar reish parashat Devarim, she'omar havlan unevarech. That prior to saying nevarech she'achalnu mishalo, which according to the Rambam is the beginning of the Berachat HaZimun, you're supposed to say Havlan the Nevarech. Ki kol mili dikdusha, because all matters of holiness boy hazman. Umize nohagin b'lashan Ashkenaz lomar avosai mevelin bench. This is the origin of the fact that we say in Yiddish when we want to say Berachat HaMazon, before we say before that phrase, there's a preliminary phrase which is Ragosai Mevelin Bench. Okay. Behein onim yehei shem Hashem avarach me'atav yad olam. Okay. So the Magen Avraham cites the Zohar as the source of our use of the phrase Ragosai Mevelin Bench. The Rambam doesn't have any equivalent of Ragosai Mevelin Bench. The Talmud mentions the phrase Havlan and Nevarech simply as part of a problem, not as part of a ceremony. If one of the people said, bring us the cup of wine so that we can make Berachat HaMazon, then does that mean that they no longer can have any further drinks? And somehow or other, this statement, which as far as the Gemara was concerned was a problem, is converted by the Zohar into a part of the ceremony. Well, let's read the Zohar. Let's read the Zohar, because the Zohar, this is one of the more fascinating passages of the Zohar, so we might as well read the Zohar. I'm refraining from reprinting Xerox and Professor Tishbius.
Do we have to say Havlan before we read the Zohar?
I don't know. The question is, where is it? Here we go. So this is the Zohar from volume 3 in Bamidbar, number 186, page 186a to 192a. I think I'll just read it in English translation rather than reading it in the Aramaic. Okay. Rabbi Isaac and Rabbi Judah were on a journey, and they came to a place called Kfar Sichnin. They lodged with a woman who had a young son, and he used to spend the whole day at school. On this particular day, he left school, went home, and saw these scholars. His mother said to him, come near to these famous men, and you'll obtain blessings from them. He approached them, but before he got too near, he turned away again. I do not want to get near them, he said to his mother, because they have not said the Shema today. And I have been taught that whoever does not say the Shema at its proper time should be shunned the whole day long. They heard him and were astonished, and they raised their hands and blessed him. They said, it is true. We have been preoccupied today with a bridegroom and his bride. They did not have the necessary prerequisites, and we had to delay their marriage, and there was no one else to assist them. So we occupied ourselves with their affairs and did not say the Shema at the proper time. For whoever is occupied with fulfilling one commandment is exempted from fulfilling another. But how did you know this, my child? He replied, I knew it from the smell of your clothes as I came toward you. They were filled with astonishment. They sat down, washed their hands, and began to eat. Rabbi Judah's hands were dirty, and he pronounced the blessing before washing. The child said to him, if you are disciples of Rabbi Shemaiah the pious, you should not have pronounced the blessing with dirty hands. Whoever pronounces the blessing with dirty hands deserves to die. The child began his discourse by quoting, when they go into the tent of the meeting, they shall wash with water, and they die not. We learn from this verse that whoever does not take care of this and appears before the king with dirty hands is punishable by death. For what reason? Because a man's hands dwell in the topmost part of the world. That is, they symbolize the Svirah. There is one finger on the man's hand, which is the finger that Moses raised, and it is written, and you shall make bars of acacia wood, five for the boards on one side of the tabernacle, and five bars for the boards on the other side of the tabernacle, and then it is written, and the middle bar among the boards shall pass from end to end. Now you might think that this middle bar is a separate one and not included in the five, but it is not so. The middle bar is one of the five, two on one side, two on the other, and one in the middle. That is, it sounds, it says that the five bars stand for the Svirot, the testing until...